Anyway, the laughing voice is the laughing voice of PBH, as in Philip Boucher Hayes, because the mystery of a sunken ship is enough to capture the imagination of every child. And we know that Philip is basically a child still. He's an RT radio broadcaster, a big child that is, because Philip has made a podcast series about a sunken shipwreck. The series is called Treasure Island, The Hunt for the Falcon Black Hole. That sounds fantastic. Episode 1, epilogue. Anyway, it's been called, and I'll quote this one because I'll stop messing, a 400-year-old mystery wrapped up in a modern-day hunt for a sunken Spanish Armada gold. Fantastic. Philip, you're very welcome.
I don't think it has been called. I think I wrote that.
Oh, did you write it? Okay. Well, it is now called because you wrote it. Yeah. Okay. Have you been dreaming of this ship since you were a kid? Well, I mean, seriously, it is a big thing that people might think of under the age of 10, you know, sunken ships.
It is. I'll tell you why I've been dreaming of it. Precisely because of everything that you read on the front page of the papers today. This story is the antidote to that completely. Mm. It's a bit of an old Scooby-Doo treasure hunt and a mystery all rolled into one. I met a guy well into his 80s at a party about a year and a half ago who told me a story, the kind of story that you should just sort of smile politely as a journalist and walk away from. But there was just something about it that kind of grabbed me. And I went away and I investigated it. Basically, his story was that in 1969, he was commissioned along with three other divers by a shadowy civil servant called Melis Clune, who had made a lifetime study of Spanish Armada ships, and this one in particular, which he believed to be a pay ship of the Spanish Armada and to be replete with all sorts of treasure chests of gold, ducats and silver pieces of eight and so on. And that he believed that he knew where it had actually gone down, as opposed to the conventional thinking that it had gone down close to the mainland near.
Any reason as to why he might have known this? Is he an expert in sunken ships?
Well, you see, precisely the kind of question that I found myself asking this poor old man, because it just seemed illogical, improbable, but at the same time, the romantic part of my brain was going, somebody is quite literally handing me a treasure map with an X on it and saying, off you go, sunshine, there's a good yarn to be had here. And my God, there was an absolutely amazing yarn.
Well, then let's get deeper into the yarn. Okay, a 430-year-old mystery began at a party, as you say. The Falcon Blanco was a Spanish Armada galleon. What does that actually mean? What does that... Does that signify something before you even start? I mean, have you got a list of everything that was on the ship?
Managed to find a guy. There is an Irish person doing every job everywhere in the world, and I needed somebody who spoke early modern Spanish and was familiar with the archives of the Spanish Museum, where everything is kept still in its original rolls. Everything is rolled up and sealed with wax seals. And I needed somebody who was going to be able to navigate their way around that, and I found the guy, and he went, and he spent ages in there for me, and we got a list of everything, an inventory, a manifest rather, everything that was in there. And look, it contradicted, all the facts started to contradict the story or the yarn right from the very beginning. The Falcon Blanco wasn't a galleon, it wasn't a warship, it was a much more prosaic thing called a hulk, which was a troop carrier, and it had on board things like olive oil and vinegar and planks of wood and manacles and chains for taking prisoners and so on, and there wasn't any evidence of it being a treasure ship, so to speak. But that doesn't mean that the bragging rights of finding a Spanish Armada ship, because there's 26 of them went down in Irish waters, and only six have ever been found. So there's 20 adventures out there to be had, and I had other pretty good indications. Like I found a Spanish shaped or styled anchor on Inishbofin, which came from the approximate area where these guys had dived about 20 or 30 years before them. And I found a cannonball, and I found all sorts of other bits and pieces of folklore, all of which seemed to kind of confirm,
hold on, are you starting from nothing? I mean, surely something else has been found somewhere along the way in the last 50, 60, maybe 100 years now?
No, absolutely nothing. There was a couple of people who had dived in the same area. There was even a professional treasure hunter, a man called Robert Stenwy, who had found, and this was the thing that most excited me about this, I suppose. this guy, Stenwee, found the treasure of the Girona, another ship in the Armada, which went down off the Giant's Causeway. How did he find it? He literally looked at the map, the place names, the map, and there was a place called Spanish Point. And he asked the question that nobody else had asked in years and years and years of trying to find Armada ships. He said, why is that place called Spanish Point?
Get John Creedon on the phone. Go on, yeah.
Why is it called Spanish Point? Well, he went, he dived, and he found hundreds of gold coins, silver coin, big, thick ropes of gold necklaces, these incredibly exquisite little gold salamanders encrusted with rubies, cameos with lapis lazuli from Afghanistan. Absolutely phenomenal treasure. And anyway, this guy had then, I found out when I went trawling through the records of the National Museum, he had turned up at one point searching for my ship, the Falcon Blanco, but not where I was searching for it, and he had come up empty-handed, and that made me feel even better that I was onto something, let's say.
Okay, so you were onto something. You went searching for somebody who could verify the accounts of the divers. You managed to track somebody down. This guy, who did you get to? Simon Avis, or is that his name?
Well, see, this is not just about history and finding out what happened 430 years ago. The real driving force of the whole story in the six-part podcast, which we're now about to reach the final part, the final episode next week, is the differing accounts of all of the divers. There's the man that I met who was very, very straightforward, straight up with what he said that he had found. But when I went and I tracked down other divers in the dive group, they all told a very, very different story. And they said, no, we found nothing. Absolutely nothing. And then, because I couldn't square all of their stories, I had to find an independent witness, somebody who had no skin in the treasure hunting game but had been there and had witnessed all of this. And as unlikely as it seems that somebody like that should exist or that I should be able to find them, I did. Right. He lives in South Africa now. And he told me, because he was the then 20-year-old boatman who brought the four divers out, and he said, straight off the bat when I Skyped him in South Africa, oh yeah, those guys found something.
Right, so it's pretty obvious that in any of these things, that like with the last furlong, we found it, now we're going to check it out. A lot of people don't want to say they found anything because they don't want people like you maybe coming in at the last bit.
Yeah, and there was an awful lot of suspicion on Inishbofin, the nearest island as well, about precisely people like me and the number and scale of Egypts who would come diving looking for wrecks if they believed that it was there.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of reasons to, if not misdirect, certainly not confirm to people where this wreck might be.
Okay, but like, you know, with all due respect, Philip, I've known you here in Orty. I've never known you to be one of these people who might go around with the diviner or something on land, or let alone go diving down the sea looking for golds or anything. So bluntly,
why am I having my midlife crisis?
Yeah, who are you?
On air.
Philip Boucher Hayes doing all this. Like, you know, you go looking for a shipwreck. How does one start to go looking for a shipwreck?
I had several moments of complete imposter syndrome doing this thing. But my guiding rod and staff throughout this was just basically, there's no reason why you can't use journalism to get to the bottom of this. You don't have to be a treasure hunter. Just go and verify everything, double source everything, prove it to your own satisfaction to be true or untrue, and see where it leads you. Follow the money, follow the gold coins. And that's what I did. And, you know, it worked. Okay, I had to go and I had to upskill my diving quite considerably. I had dived a long time ago in the Middle East as a kind of a pressure valve from covering conflict zones. I used to go off down to the Red Sea at the weekends and let off steam. But that was, you know, very shallow waters, warm waters, looking at colourful, pretty fish, diving in the Atlantic at much greater depths, looking for a wreck is an entirely different proposition altogether.
Really? I'm not surprised. Okay, let's take a look at this then. Do we know if anybody survived? Who was on it? Were they all Spanish?
This turned out to be one of the most amazing things about this is that the Armada is Ireland's greatest maritime disaster. Thousands of people died at sea, but then those that made it ashore were massacred by the English. and by the Irish as well. In Connacht alone, there was 1,100 people came on shore, and the aptly named Richard Bingham, the Flail of Connacht, put to the sword 1,100 of them.
So you're talking about like 400, 500 years ago, specifically a time.
Yeah, yeah. 430 years ago, right. There was only 750 English redcoat soldiers in Ireland at the time, and they, even though these Spanish soldiers were bedraggled and wet and cold and only wanted to go back to Spain, they were considered to be a risk, so they gathered up these prisoners and they killed all but two of them. And by this wonderful coincidence, the two that weren't killed had come from my ship and had left a number of written accounts them,
okay,
which I found in the archives and which I'm not going to say any more about on your programme.
Okay,
you can go and listen to the podcast.
Okay, right, okay, now hold on a second. Let's just take a look at this here. Okay, so like, I mean, that specific time you're talking about from 400 to 500 years ago, Spanish Armada stuff, an awful lot of people died. But I mean, there's an awful lot more stuff around Ireland, isn't there? I mean, we had a thing on the programme before. Here's a text here saying, what about all the World War II ships and ammunition that are dumped around Northern Ireland by the British Army? There's a lot of stuff out there, isn't there?
There's a lot of World War II stuff, certainly, and the guy who I got to lead the dive expedition for me has found up to a dozen different wrecks himself, mostly in the Irish Sea. He actually dived to the Titanic and tells wonderful stories.
Okay, but hold on, let's just go back to your ship here now, the Falcon Blanco from 430 years ago. I did ask, how many people do you think were on it and what was on it? You saw the manifest?
Yeah, there was only about 80 soldiers and 25, 30 sailors on board. The manifest suggests biscuit, meal, vinegar, like I was saying, planks of wood, various things that any large invasion force of 30,000 people would need, an awful lot of prosaic stuff. But because all of the men were paid in advance before they set off, they would all have been carrying their personal wealth on them and would have set sail presumably with the little bits and pieces of jewellery and other family wealth that they would have had. So there is always the hope that when you stumble across or find an Armada wreck that there will be those bits and pieces to be found as well. You're not looking for treasure chests.
Yeah,
so
like,
much as you
with
are
all due respect, to go back
effects.
To being a child, as I mentioned at the very beginning, would you not want to go to look for something, take the filthy lucre route? And like, you know, I just want the gold bars.
No, I wanted the bragging rights.
Yeah, right,
frankly.
Okay.
It's just like, yeah, you know, put that on the CV. Your man found a Spanish Armada galleon. That's
all right.
That's not bad.
So wait a minute, they're survivors.
That, you know, that'll keep you going through all of those days reporting Brexit for the rest
indeed,
of my professional career.
Right, exactly, yeah. Okay, so the sinking then, you say that a couple of people survived, is that right, at the end of it all?
Yes.
The madness of the religious war, etc.
Don Luis de Cordoba, and
of course, that would be his name.
Wait till you see
the mark of Zorro on the waves or something.
Oh, no, it gets better. He's listed on the ship's manifest, and here is a job title to aspire to now, Dave. I'm having business cards printed up. Don Luis de Cordoba is listed on the ship's manifest as a gentleman adventurer.
Fantastic. Not licensed to kill kind of stuff.
That's another thing I want to put on my CV.
Gentleman adventurer. Lovely. Okay, so the divers, what were they hoping to find? Is it treasure, how we imagine then? Wooden chest, shiny gold? It's just trinkets of the guys who were there and maybe a bit of olive oil. Is that, that's, come on.
No. When they went down in 1969, mysterious Melis Clune had filled their heads with all kinds of tales of possible untold wealth because...
What nationality is Melis Clune? Irish?
Really? It's a most peculiar name, and I spent weeks trying to find any relatives of his. I searched up and down the eastern seaboard of the United States to where they had all supposedly moved, finally found somebody who told me, oh yeah, you want to talk to the family historian who lived, it turned out, 5 miles down the road from me, which was incredibly frustrating. But they went off in the belief, as a lot of people had at that time in 1969, after Robert Stenwee had discovered the treasure of the Girona, the entire country went potty for a while with tales of untold wealth and believing that we were going to solve the national debt by going and finding all of these sunken Spanish Armada ships at the time. And there was
there was reason to believe that, you know, when you looked at the Girona, that those schoolboy fantasies and tales were actually true.
Listen, I lived a little bit of this myself. My father was a commissioner of the Board of Works, and one of the things was like heritage stuff and big castles and all that sort of stuff. And when they found the Derry na Flann chalice, and he had been retired at that stage, and he got a phone call from somebody, and he just kept his mouth shut for about a year. He didn't tell his wife, my mother, in other words. He told nobody. And I remember he put down the phone, and it was a big thing. What was that? That was Jack on the phone. What was he on about? Can't tell you. It was brilliant. Anyway, I was going to ask you, did you ever go searching yourself? But of course, what's the point in asking that when I can play this clip here from the podcast? Are you ready for this? Philip's first dive.
I'm clear behind, Philip.
Clear behind. Okay, thank you.
The sky was almost on the ground for our first dive, so there was next to no sunlight. 10 metres down, I could barely see beyond the end of my arm.
I can't make anything out of the wall.
It was extremely disorienting. If I wasn't able to see which way my bubbles were going, I wouldn't have been able to tell up from down. That, and my ears refusing to equalise as we went deeper. How do you find a shipwreck when you can't even find the seabed?
Dun, 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 dun. Were those bubbles real, were they?
No, that was a moment of real imposter syndrome going down. And said, I can't even find the bloody ground, never mind. So start looking.
Scared. Okay, yeah. By the way, you went down. What's the past tense for dive? Is it really dove, is it? You dived. Anyway,
I dived.
You dived with practiced divers, right?
Oh, yeah. Now, the man who led this expedition had also been down to the Titanic. You know, he knew his potatoes when it came to diving. And we needed somebody who did, because this is not an area for amateurs to be arsing around in. And they really did hold my hand throughout the entire thing. Because when we got down to the depth that we thought that we should be at, with very little search time because we were so deep, the air in your tank is compressed, and you only had about 15 minutes at the bottom before you had to surface and do decompression stops on the way up and so on. And I was naturally so excited that I was hair and offer all over the place saying, what's that over there? What's that? No, that. And the visibility was only at 4 or 5 metres, so everything looked like it might be a mound of something on the horizon.
But was it completely different? Illusions. Was the terrain underneath, was it completely different than the ones you did on the Saturday afternoons when you took time off in the Middle East?
Completely. I mean, you're talking an entirely...
We're talking wild and murky.
I mean, it was...
And dark.
Dark on the way down, and I would only have ever been diving, pottering around in beautiful azure waters looking at coloured fish at 10 or 15 metres. This is a different proposition.
Did you practice the martini effect beforehand?
I had to be tested to see if I was going to succumb to nitrogen narcosis. This is some people, the nitrogen in your air tank, along with the oxygen, ends up having an anaesthetic effect. Mm. So I went to a quarry in Tipperary and went down to 30 metres and did a number of different tests. And I had a real imposter syndrome moment then, because on the way down, I was blowing on my nose so hard, trying to equalise the pressure in my ears, I gave myself a nosebleed, so I had blood all over the inside of my mask, which stopped me from being able to see that the air valve in my dry suit was in the locked position. So as I was coming back up, my suit was full of air, and I was just floating uncontrollably towards the top, and I was supposed to do a decompression stop to stop myself from getting the bends, and I wasn't able to stop because the air just kept on expanding. I kept on going up.
And people give out about RT journalists.
I know.
Mother of God.
I figured out the hack of just sticking a finger down into the arm of my suit and flooding it with water and letting the air out. And I just came to a stop at 5 metres where I had to stop for 3 or 4 minutes, only to realise that I had run out of bloody air in my tank. Now, I was perfectly safe because I was able to turn to the instructor and say, I'm out of air. Please, can I breathe yours for the remaining 4 or 5 minutes of the dive? But I had one of those real, if I can't do this properly in the controlled circumstances of a quarry where there's no waves, tides, current, it's perfectly bright, do I really have any business going and diving, looking for shipwrecks in the Atlantic?
Listen, we better get to something here, so hold on a second. Right? We haven't got to the ship yet. So hold on a second. I'm going to look. I've a clip here about a piece of lead. What's that about?
I learned over the course of this to redefine my expectations about what treasure actually was. And one of the guys that I talked to was this archaeologist, Colin Martin, who had found three of the Spanish Armada wrecks himself, or had been involved in expeditions where they were found. And of all of the treasure that he found, all of the gold and whatever else, the thing that he remembers the most is this human connection that he made with somebody when he found a little piece of lead with teeth marks in it.
Okay, we'll give a blast of that.
We found a scrap of lead on the Trinidad Valencera. It was a little bit, it was like a wafer. It was a thin piece of sheet lead. And right in the middle of it, there were the impressions of human teeth that had almost bitten the lead in half.
In spite of being underwater at the time, with a lot of other things on his mind, Colin made an instant human connection across four centuries.
Unquestionably, that had been given to somebody who was going to undergo an operation, probably an amputation, without anaesthetic, and this is what they'd placed between his teeth.
Wow, Colin seems like an amazing person. He's playing the lute at the same time as talking to you. That's incredible. Wow,
but what
an amazing
he
man.
Said, he said to me, look, I won't say that I could feel the man's pain, but there was this moment of zing, and he saw him there. He knew what he was going through, and that, in a career of diving, in a career of finding all kinds of treasure, that's the thing that he remembers now the most. It's the human experience.
Okay, then, like, I mean, by the way, we're talking here about episode 6, the final episode, but it's all there, of course, of Treasure Island, The Hunt for the Falcon Blanco, broadcast in Drive Time Radio 1.
Yeah, well, episodes 1 to 5 are all available
as
podcasts.
And the last one's this coming Wednesday at 6:30, and then other episodes are available on iTunes, Spotify, RT.ie, etc. So, you know, with the developments that we have, like sonar, somebody has mapped the whole of outer Ireland. Why haven't they found other? Is it 20 you mentioned from the Armada?
Yeah. It's a good question. There's the information is all there in the Geological Survey of Ireland. It's just a question of pressing the right buttons and filtering out all the background noise and the seaweed and the waves and so on, perhaps to find what is still there. An awful lot of these ships, though, they're made from wood. Then very few of them ended up being preserved, like the Mary Rose, intact in the mud in Portsmouth Harbour. Most of it would have been scattered to the four seas. And an awful lot of it, because I found during the course of this hunt, I found bits and pieces of the Falcon Blanco that had washed ashore and had been incorporated into sheds and barns, and they were now the beams, the overhead beams, because we analysed some of the wood and said, oh, it's definitely
not. Well, then, hold on, what is there to find there, or can we find that out at 6:30 on Drive Time on Wednesday? Is that it?
Well done, Dave.
Right,
you're good at this.
This is like a box set on radio kind of thing, you know. Don't wait. Between now and Wednesday, listen to the first five.
Between now and Wednesday, listen to the first five. This is our first kind of foray into what some people call long-form narrative. Others might just say dragged-out shaggy dog story. But basically, there's a great journey to be had over the course
of and your great journey as a journalist. I mean, is this your first from the bottom of the ocean?
Yeah, I've reported from five continents and then said, okay, where's left? I went down to 30 metres under the Atlantic.
Right, brilliant. Okay, so we definitely got to listen up to next Wednesday for the whole thing, right? And then check up the last one, 6:30 on Drive Time here, over there on Radio 1, I should say.
On the senior service.
On the senior
service.
No, on our sister service, you know, or whatever those
the
phrases
senior
are.
Senior service, where they don't like you and they don't know what to do with me.
Right, okay, fair enough. That's on RTE. By the way, RTE.ie, Spotify, iTunes, that's where you get the other episodes available. And it's actually called, it does have a title, as I say, Treasure Island, The Hunt for the Falcon Blanco, and that's Philip Badger-Hayes. Where are you going next, Philip, after all this?
I'm making a documentary on climate change.
Are you?
I am.
Right, okay,
yeah.
Fair enough.
No, it's good news. There is potentially good news there. Have me back in 2 months' time and we'll talk about it.
Okay, good man yourself, Philip. Thank you very much indeed, Philip Boucher-Hayes.
Dave Fanning.